Welcome to Signs of Life, exploring survival of consciousness, brought to you by Forever Family Foundation, on the web at foreverfamilyfoundation.org.
I call your name, the echo is haunting, the echo is always the same. I call your name, the echo is haunting, an echo can never be changed. So I call your name, your name.
And welcome to the gathering. Oh, I made a mistake. Today's not a gathering. Today's an interview show. I'm sorry. Welcome to Signs of Life Radio. I'm Bob Ginsberg. We have a special guest tonight, Dr. Jim Tucker. And before I introduce Dr. Tucker, I'll mention if you ever had a question about past life memories of children or reincarnation, now's your chance because you have a world authority on this subject. So if you want to call in with a question, you can. And the number at the radio station is 888-627-6008. Jim B. Tucker, MD, is the Bonner Lowry Professor of Psychiatry and Neurobehavioral Sciences at the University of Virginia. He is director of the University of Virginia's Division of Perceptual Studies, where he is continuing the work of Ian Stevenson with children who report memories of previous lives. Is the author of Before, Children, Memories of Previous Lives, a two-in-one edition of his books, Life Before Life and Return to Life, which together have been translated into 20 languages. Dr. Tucker attended the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill, for both undergraduate studies and medical school, and he received his training in general psychiatry and child psychiatry at the University of Virginia. He joined the UVA faculty in 2000, and in addition to his research work, he is the director of the Child and Adolescent Psychiatry Training Program. I should mention he's also on the Forever Family Foundation Scientific Advisory Board, and his website is jimbtucker.com. So nice to have you back, Jim.
Oh, well, Bob, it's great to be back. It's been a while.
Yeah, it has. So, even if I wind up asking you some of the questions that I have in the past, nobody's going to remember. So.
Sounds good.
Let's start at the beginning. I'm sure you've been asked this before, but, how does a medical doctor become interested in past life memories of children and reincarnation?
Yeah, so I did my psychiatry training here, as you mentioned, and I had heard about this Ian Stevenson, who had been the chairman of the Department of Psychiatry when he stepped down to focus on these cases of young children who said they remembered a past life. I thought it was curious, but I didn't think anything more than that. And then after my training, I went into private practice and was there for 9 years. Just doing standard child psychiatry practice. And then when my wife and I got together, she was interested in things like psychic abilities and reincarnation and various things, which I had never given any serious thought to. So that got me intrigued. And I wasn't feeling completely fulfilled in private practice. So when we saw in the local paper that Dr. Stevenson's research group had gotten a grant to do a new study on near-death experiences, I decided to call to see if they needed any help interviewing patients. And as it turned out, I never worked on that study, but that sort of got my foot in the door. And eventually I came on, well, for a year half-time, and then I left my private practice and joined faculty full-time. So now it's been 22 years.
Yeah.
But it wasn't specifically the question of past life memories or reincarnation that particularly intrigued me, but what I was really interested in more generally was the question of life after death and the possible evidence for it. So the subject matter intrigued me, and also the approach that the research division was using, which was very serious-minded, kind of looking for evidence, trying to explore a phenomenon just like you would any other phenomenon. It just happens to be the question of survival after death.
Yeah. So, I mean, it's important before we get into actual subject of past life memories of children. We've talked about your background and that you're the director of the Division of Perceptual Studies. So tell us a little bit more about what the division does.
Yeah, so the division, which has been going on now for 55 years, focuses on the question of consciousness, that the idea of mind and brain, and is mind purely due to brain, or can it operate in some ways separate from the brain? And one way it would do that would be if the brain dies. So there's our work with the reincarnation memories. And then Bruce Grayson is a very much a leading authority on near-death experiences. And he's published scores of articles and has now published a book. So that work is continuing. Our newest faculty member, Marietta Pelvanova, works in both of these areas, both near-death experiences as well as helping me with the reincarnation cases. In addition, we have a neuroimaging lab that focuses primarily on EEG and trying to sort out what's going on in the brain while people are having extraordinary experiences, including mediumship. So that they're currently doing a study with mediums. And in fact, just had a medium in the lab this week. It got slowed down considerably by the pandemic. But now they're back up and doing in-person kind of work. But not just that. They also look at psychic abilities, sometimes out-of-body experiences, various things to try to do measurements and both validate the experiences, but also try to explore how the people are able to do those things.
So basically, everything that you do is investigating whether one's consciousness or mind can act independently of one's physical brain.
Exactly.
Okay.
Yes.
Yeah. You know, I thought I would ask you some, you know, we get asked a lot of questions during the radio shows and at events and so forth about reincarnation. I think there's some renewed interest when, you know, your work and others was featured on the Netflix Surviving Death series. And so, you know, and I, people seem to ask the same kind of questions over and over again. They're never quite satisfied with the answers. But let's start with the biggie that people are wondering whether the evidence from, well, let's say, all the cases that you've studied over the years and your predecessor Ian Stevenson, does it suggest that reincarnation, returning to physical life, is a choice, or, you know, not that not everyone reincarnates?
Well, yeah, that's a really good question. I mean, as far as the choice part goes, there are some children who say that they were given a choice, or at least where to come back to, so that they could watch their parents and decide they wanted to be born to them, or sometimes their guides will lead them to the next life. But as far as whether we all come back here, the cases don't really answer that. I mean, you know, it may well be that we all do, but it may also be that the kids with the memories are sort of exceptions, that's not the usual process, that consciousness, mind may continue on, but not necessarily in this realm, that it at times comes back here and other times goes on to have different kinds of experiences.
Yeah. So, you know, if by the very nature that these children are talking about, in some cases, choosing their parents, you know, or making decisions about their next life, that suggests that there is a life between lives, that there's a period of time between the physical incarnation and then after physical death, that they spend, there's some time, or maybe not time as we know it, but before they come back. But I don't think in the cases as much discussion of between lives, is there?
Well, about 20% of the kids will describe some events between lives. So most don't, but some do, and occasionally with verifiable details, either about what happened after the previous person died, say watching the previous family do things, or sometimes observing, like I mentioned, observing their future parents, sometimes giving details that shock and frankly dismay their parents about things they did. So there is some evidence that, yes, there is this in-between life, this intermission period may not be a blank, but may just be a different kind of experience.
Yeah. You know, the major question that I think a lot of people battle with is, why would somebody, choose to return to a physical life that's filled with hardship or emotional or physical, distress and a host of other things, and that gets into a more of a spiritual question, because, perhaps it's because we just can't think of it in physical terms. But is there any overlap, like with the NDE cases? Do the children ever report that, that in their prior life when they died, that they were told that it's, for instance, that it's not their time yet and they had to stay longer or?
Well, we don't get that, of course, those people come back. But some of the kids do describe what essentially is a near-death experience of floating above their body, sometimes seeing other beings. Some of them will describe going to heaven. The American kids may use the word heaven. But you raise an important question, which I can't say we necessarily have the answer to, but, is the suffering that we all experience, is it part of a plan, or is it at times just sort of a naturalistic process where that kind of happens? So, do we have all this mapped out? Or like in these cases, some of the children complain bitterly about where they are in their new life and how much they miss their old one. So it doesn't seem like they chose it. But beyond that, is there a purpose to this, or is it just kind of what happens? Through a naturalistic kind of thing, especially since most of the previous lives ended violently or by some unnatural means. And did that mean that kind of held the spirit, if we want to use that word, the mind, to this realm, so then it somehow got attached to a new body and was born? Or is it sort of the next chapter in an overall picture of existence where you go through rough stuff, you go through easy stuff, but it's all sort of toward a single goal. So it's sort of like when someone's working out of the gym, they are quote unquote suffering. I mean, they are intentionally choosing to put themselves in pain or exhaustion to try to make themselves stronger. Well, is that analogous to what we may do with these lives? But I have to say that sort of thinking works a lot better conceptually than it does emotionally. If you look at the specifics of what people go through, the horrible suffering and terrible things that happen to people, or including young children, it's not very satisfying to think, well, maybe it's just part of a plan. It seems like, well, what kind of plan is that? Yes, those are big issues and big questions to ponder.
Yeah, virtually every book that you read that about spirituality talks about this physical existence as a school where we learn lessons, and then the reason we come back is because we have more lessons to learn. I always, when I first started reading about reincarnation, I had a hard time grasping that concept, because when you come back, to learn this lesson, supposedly that you need to complete your soul or whatever it is, and you have no memory of what that lesson is, you know, how do you know? How do you learn if you don't know what you need to work on? You know, it's like,
right.
You know, that was always troubling to me, you know? So,
well, all right. So it wouldn't be facts particularly, but yeah. You know, I don't remember anything in the first 3 years of my life, but that, or even more than that, really, first four or five, I have virtually no memory. And yet presumably those experiences help shape who I am as an adult. So, you know, you can make a case it would be similar kind of process.
Yeah, I find that the general misconception, I guess it is among the public regarding reincarnation, everybody that I talk to just assumes that it takes, you know, many, many years to reincarnate, you know, that it might, in terms of our time, it might take, you know, 10 years or 20 years. But your research has found that I think the average time between lives is 18 months, I think I recall. Is that true?
That would be the average is 4.5 years. But if you look at the median, yeah, it's more like 18 months. Mm-hmm. Because, you know, we have some cases that are 50 years, so that obviously stretches out the average. But yeah, most of them are recent. And now, partly that's because we can't really identify typically a previous personality who was, you know, lived 200 years ago. So there's some selection kind of bias there. The more recent it is, the more likely we are to be able to identify the previous person. Mm-hmm. And of course, we do have quite a few cases where the child talks sometimes at great length about a past life, but nobody's able to verify that it actually matches a life. So that's much more likely to happen with an ancient life than it would be a recent one. All that being said, you know, yes, we've got plenty of cases that are very recent. So I think partly people may have that perception because with a lot of the hypnotic regression work, people recall lives from a long time ago. But that doesn't mean that, I mean, even if you believe in hypnotic regression, that doesn't mean that it's not possible for it to be a much shorter interval.
Yeah. Any thoughts as to why these past life memories fade as children get older?
Well, my thought is that for all of us, like I mentioned, I don't have any memories of anything, or virtually no memories before the age of five. Even though there were things that were in my long-term memory. I mean, if you have a grandparent who you know and love, but if you're 3 years old when that person dies, well, by the time you're 7 or 8, you're probably not going to remember them. And so it would kind of make sense that you would lose the past life memories at the same time that you lose your early childhood memories. And it is because the brain is going through tremendous changes during that time, kind of pruning out what it doesn't need. And so our early memories leave. And it seems like the past life memories typically do. Now, there are exceptions. There are adults who say that they still have at least some memories of their past life.
Yeah, a lot of adults, it seems, you know, yeah. That, you know, and that's what they attribute all their phobias to.
So, right.
Yeah. So some of the most compelling cases that you've researched and are with birthmarks. So just tell our audience a bit about that and some possible explanations as how that might occur.
Yeah, so those are cases where the child is born with birthmarks or even full birth defects that match wounds, usually the fatal wounds, on the body of the previous personality who died. And, you know, that can be a little bit mind-blowing. So, you know, how did a injury on one body kind of show up in the next life? I mean, even if you believe in reincarnation. The way I like to think of it is that it's not necessarily the injury on the body itself, but more the impact that it has on the mind, that that image affects the mind, sort of imprints it. And then when it starts over in a new life, those images then affect the developing fetus. And we do know from other kinds of work that mental images can produce very specific effects at times on the body. So in this case, it would be kind of like PTSD. It'd be this very traumatic memory and image that then affects the developing fetus and leads to a similar birthmark or birth defect in the child.
Okay, here's the number one question that we get, and it's every show, and I'll let you answer instead of my feeble explanation every time. So people want to know that once their loved one in spirit chooses to reincarnate, you know, does that mean that communication can no longer take place between the deceased person and those remaining in the physical? So, you know, especially this comes up with children, and people say, I don't want my child to reincarnate because I'll never be able to be in touch with them. Mm-hmm. So how do you answer that?
Well, I mean, we've toyed with the idea of doing some kind of study that would combine the two, mediumship with past life memories. But I think that we are not necessarily just one thing, that we sort of have different natures, and we can have sort of the larger mind that is kind of on the other side, and then also part of our mind that then has an existence here. So yes, mediums could connect with a soul even after that soul is in a new body, having a new life.
Because we're fragments of many lives, and you know, that all perhaps go to an oversoul, I guess, right?
Yeah, exactly. And you know, if you look at like the people who have near-death experiences, often talk about when they have a life review is not necessarily in order, it's all at once. So, you know, time has sort of a different nature, or maybe it's not even time, sort of on the other side. So again, you can be kind of in two places at once. It's sort of like a metaphor I've used before is like an actor who has different parts in movies. So, or you can pick any actor, but say Jimmy Stewart, where, you know, there are Jimmy Stewart parts where he's playing similar characters, but different ones in different roles. So in each film, he is existing in that film, but there's also the larger him, the real Jimmy Stewart, who exists separate from it. And it may be that that's how our realities are for us. There's the larger soul and the larger reality, but then there's us down here as well.
Hmm. So in those cases where children talk about an in-between, you know, lives, do they ever mention some of the things common to NDEs, like seeing deceased relatives or observing earthly events and that kind of thing?
They do talk about observing earthly events, and some of them will describe, for instance, seeing the funeral of the previous person, occasionally giving verifiable details. So like there's a little girl in Thailand that Ian Stevenson studied, where she made all kinds of statements, but one of the things was she complained that her ashes had been scattered rather than buried the way she wanted them to be. Well, it turned out the previous person was a woman who wanted her ashes buried under the Bo tree of the temple complex where she studied. But when her daughter went to bury them, the root system of the tree was so extensive that she couldn't. So she scattered them instead. So that was a verified detail that the child gave about events between lives.
Yeah. Which is cool because you have tangible evidence.
Yeah, exactly.
So So what, how does it play out, you know, as a, you know, a scientist and a researcher, you get alerted to a situation where a child is reporting some extraordinary facts about a previous life that gets brought to your attention. Where do you go from there? How do you begin to investigate?
Well, it sort of depends, of course, on the details of the case, but often we will do sort of internet sleuthing. I mean, if a child gives details, you know, then we're trying to see, can those details be verified to match an actual past life? And, you know, unfortunately, they don't often just spit out everything that makes it easy to look them up, but that they may give, say, a first name, or they may give a state. And so we do that kind of work. And if it's promising, then we will interview the child and the parents, usually in person, although lately, of course, we've done some by Zoom. But and then we kind of take him from there. Now, I've had a couple of cases where, and one of them's on the Netflix series, where there were enough details where we could identify whose life the child seemed to be remembering. So I did some picture tests where I would show the child one picture from that life and another one, a control picture that wasn't part of that life, and see if the child could pick out the right one. And the one on Netflix, I think the child was 5 out of 5 on the picture test. There's another case where a child remembered being dying in the Vietnam War, an American who died in the Vietnam War. And he was 6 for 6 on the picture tests. So when we're able to do that, I think that adds a nice piece of again, tangible evidence that the child does have a connection to the past life.
Hmm. And personally, I think out of all the cases that I've read, I think that the case of Ryan and Marty Martin is so unusual and so compelling that, you know, it's hard to refute. Can you give us a brief overview of that case?
Sure. Yeah. So, yeah, Ryan was a little boy in Oklahoma who around the age of 4 started talking about a past life in Hollywood and would get very upset about it and saying how much he missed his past life and so forth. So his mom checked out a couple of books from the public library about Hollywood to see, because she had heard that seeing things from the past life could help a child process these memories and then move on. So they were looking through one of the books one day when they came to a picture from an old movie called Night After Night. And he pointed to one guy and said, "Hey, Mama, that's George." And it turned out it was George Raft, who was a well-known actor in his day. And then he pointed to another guy and said, "And Mama, that's me. I found me." Well, that guy that he pointed to was an extra with no lines in the movie. So Ryan's mom wrote to me to see if I could help figure out who this guy was. And so I flew out to Oklahoma and met them, talked with them. And then afterwards, I mean, it seemed like it's going to be quite a struggle to figure out who this was. But while we were looking, his mom was sending me emails, sometimes on a daily basis, about all of these statements that Ryan was making about his past life. Frankly, ones that I thought were unlikely to be from an extra with no lines in a movie. Eventually, with the help of a Hollywood archivist, we were able to figure out who this guy was. The archivist, she went to the library of the Academy of Motion Picture Arts and Sciences and collected all the materials about Night After Night, most of which were about the stars of the movie. Not just George Raft, is also the first movie that Mae West was in. But then there was one picture of this guy, and on the back of it, it gave his name, Marty Martin. So we could then look at this long list of a couple hundred statements that Ryan had made and see how well they matched with Marty Martin. So we collected the records that we could. And then we also were able to locate Marty Martin's daughter. Marty Martin died in 1964, so he'd been gone a long time. But his daughter was only 8 when he died. Now, there's a lot about his life that she didn't know because she was so young, including even about one of his sisters. But combining what she knew along with the records, we were eventually able to document or verify over 50 of Ryan's statements matched Marty Martin's life. There were a few that were incorrect, and then there were a lot that were unverifiable, just little details about daily life that we weren't able to verify one way or another. But over 50 of them did fit, and it turned out that this extra had quite a life. So Ryan had talked about dancing on stage in New York, and Marty Martin had danced on Broadway. And Ryan then said that he went to Hollywood to work in the movies, which Marty Martin did, working mostly on dance in the movies. Then Ryan said that he worked at an agency where people changed their names, and Marty Martin started a successful talent agency. Ryan said how he talked about seeing the world from big boats and going to Paris, and Marty Martin and his wife went to Europe on the Queen Mary. Ryan said he had this big house with a swimming pool, which Marty Martin did. But Ryan also said that the address had the word rock or mount in it, and Marty Martin lived on North Roxbury. In addition, Ryan said one time that he didn't see why God would let you get to be 62 and then come back as a baby. And Marty Martin's death certificate said that he was 59 when he died. But his daughter and his stepson both said he was, in fact, 62. So I looked into it. I found 3 census records, 2 marriage listings, and a passenger list that all gave ages that meant, in fact, Marty Martin was 62 when he died and not 59. So even though the death certificate said 59, Ryan was even correct on that one when he said 62.
Yeah. So when you look at those things, even though you have an objective eye, you know, you have to just sit and go, wow. You know, it's like,
well, that's right. It gets pretty hard to deny that something is going on there.
Yeah. What I also like about cases like that, as you mentioned, there were 50 very specific, facts that were researched and turned out to be true. So you can calculate basically, you know, odds against chance of that happening, similar to the mediumship world. You know, medium gives a reading and, you know, I mean, getting 1 or 2 pieces of information, mm-hmm. okay. But, you know, when it gets to the point where there are 25 specific pieces yeah. of information, the odds against chance could get up to the millions to one. So
yeah, that's right.
Yeah. So I think that's, that's great when you're able to verify so much. Yeah. Do you find that there's a lot of personality matches between the old person, you know, the old life and the new life?
Well, it's a little hard to say, partly because the kids are so young when we see them, and also partly because it's hard sometimes to get a detailed sort of personality history of the previous person. But we do, so with all our cases, we code them on 200 variables and put them into a database. And we do code for a few personality features. And again, it's kind of rough science, but when we look, there is a statistically significant correlation between the features that the previous person shows and the ones that the child does. I think a reasonable way to put it is that there is some carryover or predilection to have particular characteristics, but as we know, experiences in this life, not to mention genetics, that, you know, have a big impact on how we turn out. So the past life stuff would just be one more aspect of all this that we may bring into this life, but then our experiences after that would certainly shape how we turn out.
Yeah. For those that are tuned in late, we are talking with Dr. Jim Tucker. He's the author of Before, which is a combination of his books, Life Before Life and Return to Life. If you did have a question for Dr. Tucker, you can call in at 888-627-6008. Jim, what about, you know, I know where from reading your books that there are cases where people have certain habits and, you know, like, and phobias, you know, like somebody that never smoked, before. I mean that goes in with surgery, right? With transplanted people that they never smoked before, and then they get an organ transplant and they want to smoke. So, do you find that in your cases, the children have certain phobias of that would be, for instance, you know, a phobia about, you know, drowning, and then they drowned in their previous life or things like that?
Yes, we definitely see those. So in the unnatural death cases like drowning or violence or whatever, or car accidents for that matter, over 35% of the kids show this intense fear toward the mode of death. And the drowning is a good example because it seems to happen more commonly actually with drowning than some of the other cases, some of the other ways of dying. So like there's this little girl who basically from the time she was born hated being in water. It would take three adults to hold her down to give her a bath when she was an infant. And then when she got older enough to talk, describe a life of a girl in another village who had drowned in an accident. So yeah, there's definitely that kind of thing, which again is kind of like PTSD. I mean, it seems like that and of course PTSD involves memories that people wish they didn't have, but they kind of can't get rid of them. And along with that can come avoidance or fears about things. And it seems like those traumatic kinds of things can carry over even across lifetimes. Mm-hmm. But for that matter, addictions can too. You mentioned smoking, and we've had a number of cases where the previous person was a heavy smoker or a heavy drinker, then the little child would be trying to sneak cigarettes or sometimes even sneak liquor because they're so drawn to them, just like the previous person was.
Hmm. Yeah, that's wild. Is it true that people that died as a result of an accident or through violence are more likely to reincarnate quicker?
That's a good question. And I don't remember the answer to it. I think we have looked at it, and I think you're right, but I would have to review to see if in fact that's the case.
I think I did recall reading that in one of your books, but
I've forgotten my own books.
What about prodigies? Any correlation? Have you looked into that with a child prodigy, somebody that's gifted incredibly, let's say, with music or art, and that gets traced back to a previous life?
Well, I mean, the short answer is basically not exactly. So, yeah, I mean, you see these prodigies with these completely inexplicable abilities. But the ones that are known as prodigies, I'm not aware that any of them have said that they had a past life where they had those skills. Now, on the other hand, with some of our cases, we have had the children to show an unusual level of skill, not necessarily the prodigy level, but we have at least one where a case I saw of a little boy who bit of a long story, but basically said that he had been Bobby Jones, who was a famous golfer back in like the 1920s or whatever. Yeah. And this kid was a golfing prodigy. Even, I mean, his parents didn't even play golf. And dad had videos of him at like 4 or 5 with an unbelievably smooth stroke. And that kid ended up winning dozens of, maybe scores of golf tournaments. I haven't heard from them lately. I don't know how he has done into sort of teen years, but he was close to a golfing prodigy. I mean, he wasn't Tiger Woods, but he was winning a whole lot of golf tournaments against older kids. So that was one that was close to that. And there are others where maybe not quite that dramatic, but they either have skills that mystify people or they were so much better than you would think, that they caught on so much more quickly, became good at it more than you would expect a kid to.
Yeah. I mean, so we know that from NDE research that many people return with enhanced psychic ability, fairly, I guess, large percentage of people. Any evidence in children that come back, any evidence that they have psychic ability?
Some of them show those abilities, and Ryan was one, but most of them do not. And I don't know if our case is if it's more or less than the general population, you know, because we don't have good numbers on that.
Yeah.
But it's a very small percentage where the families report any sort of psychic abilities at all.
So I know in mediumship, the skeptics will use the argument that a medium is not really communicating with a discarnate. They are simply, and that's as if it was easy, pulling information from a field of information or similar to an Akashic Records or a field of consciousness. So so they're just extracting information. I'm sure that argument has been used regarding past life memories of children, that they're, how do you address that?
Well, I think there are a few things. One, when you have verified memories of time between lives, that gets to be more of a stretch. I mean, what it is suggesting is that this entity has continued to live and has continued to have experiences. The birthmark cases, I think, are very hard to explain on an Akashic Record kind of explanation. And there's also the emotional piece. I mean, these kids are not just pulling out a list of facts. They are often getting very upset about either traumatic things they experience or how much they miss people from that life, crying, begging to be taken to their previous parents. So certainly the child's experience is that these memories are memories of things that they had in that they experienced in their last life, that it is not just pulling out information from the Akashic Records. I think with the mediumship work, I think it's more worth considering. I mean, especially when, you know, you have these controls that are then, thinking about like with Mrs. Piper, where, Dr. Finn Wee or whatever seemed clearly to be a creation of her mind. So makes you wonder if these other entities that he was communicating with, if they were also a psychic kind of thing. So not to get too much into doubting mediumship, I mean, it's amazing stuff, but I mean, they both have that potential that is worth exploring, but I think it's a real stretch with these cases.
Yeah, you know, with mediumship, I think that one of the best arguments against that theory of pulling out information is that you could make the argument that it's possible to extract data from a field, but how do you extract a personality, you know? Mm-hmm. You know, so That kind of leans more towards the,
well, exactly. I agree. And of course, with modern mediums, they're not using controls anyway. I mean, they're seemingly, connecting right with the deceased person. And you're right, the personality can come through. And that's not purely from information. So, how you explain that with some sort of psychic Akashic record thing, I think, also becomes a stretch.
So most of the cases that Ian Stevenson investigated took place in other countries. I assume that's because reincarnation is more accepted in other countries, not as much in the U.S. I guess that's a problem for you as a researcher, right? I mean, in coming upon cases. Maybe if a parent has a child that's talking about a past life, they just hush him up or take him to a psychiatrist or,
certainly that happens. But it used to be a lot more of a problem than it is now. So, in countries with a belief in reincarnation, those cases sometimes are in the newspaper. So, Ian went where he could find the cases, and he had associates looking for them in places like India or Thailand or Burma, a lot of them in Burma. And so that's where he found them. Yes, they're harder to find here, but fortunately now the parents find us because with the internet, their child is doing this strange thing about talking about a past life. So, they go online and start doing a search and they come across us. So then they can contact us. Now, I'm sure we only get a tiny percentage of the cases, and you're right, there's some where the parents would just reject it. Tell the kid to shut up and, just think it's nonsense. And then there are plenty of others where they are intrigued, but they don't want anyone to know. I mean, that happens a lot, but don't even want someone like us to know. But then there are plenty of parents that are reaching out to us and telling us about what their kids are saying.
Yeah. Well, I guess you also have to be somewhat guarded, because it's a double-edged sword. Now, people see the TV series, this information age, and people are always want to be in the public eye, and, you're a prominent researcher, so they're going to contact you. So, maybe you have to really weed out these cases, right? It's a problem.
Well, yeah, except most of the parents do not want to be in the public eye because, again, it's not accepted here. And I mean, there are exceptions, but a lot of them, when we've had opportunities for television or whatever, it's hard to get hard to find families that will agree to even do it. But it is a double-edged sword in the sense that if a child starts given some details, it's great that we can research it online, but the parents can also research it online.
Yeah.
Which can then really taint the case if they've done a lot of investigating themselves.
I it doesn't have anything to do with your work, but with this, now with the pandemic, the medium stopped doing personal in-person readings, and everything was taking place on Zoom and other meeting platforms. And one of our certified mediums was telling us that they caught another medium who was doing a reading for a sitter. And, when you register in one of these platforms, the host has your first and last name. And on one side of the screen, the medium had up the sitter. And on the other side of the screen, the medium had up the sitter's Facebook page. And the medium was simply reading back every piece of information. And of course, the sitter is, people don't know how mediumship works, And the sitter thinks this is the greatest medium that ever lived.
Yeah.
And it was a total fraudulent reading.
Right. I mean, I think fraud and often, maybe it's just sort of well-meaning kidding themselves kind of stuff. But I think it's a much bigger issue in mediumship work than it is with these cases, because mediums can charge money. And with our cases, the families don't get anything out of it. And again, I mean, occasionally there are ones who, want to get some publicity, but those are a distinct minority. It's usually much the other way.
Yeah. Have you, while we're at it, have you gotten a lot of, increased interest since the Netflix series? I know we certainly did, I mean, you know, Bruce Grayson, you know, was featured, yeah, and you were, yeah, featured, and several other folks. So, did we
Yeah. Okay. Right. Yeah. I mean, we've both the last 2 years, we've had over 100 families contact us to tell us about what their kids were saying. So yeah, it certainly increased the traffic that way, and increased interest in the phenomenon.
Yeah. Which is a good thing. You know, I mean, I guess they accomplished what they set out to do in opening up, you know, people's minds, you know, to the at least the possibility that we survived that. At the end of Return, we touched on this a little bit earlier, but in the end of Return to Life, you speculated about what you called the big picture, and you suggested that each of us may be like a single train of thought in one large mind, you know, that consciousness survives across lifetimes. And I think you wrote that experiences that are separated by distance and years can be connected and intertwined. So, but do you believe that we always retain our individual memories and personalities?
Well, I mean, I think reality and us and mind and everything, they're probably more complicated than our physical brains are able to understand.
Yeah, agreed.
So, I mean, I do think it's reasonable to say that we may all be much more connected than we're aware, and it may well be like it's all one large mind. But I'm drawn toward the idea of there also being individual continuation. And our cases provide evidence of that, I mean, indisputably. So, you know, whether eventually we sort of dissolve into the, you know, the grand sea of consciousness, I don't know. But certainly our cases would suggest, at least from one life to a second life, that there are things that are different. I mean, we've certainly evolved or changed, but there is definitely this continuation, this individual continuation. So it's not just sort of the waves of the sea where they all, you know, then dissolve, but there is this intact thing, entity that we each are, that continues on.
Yeah. And I think a lot of people find that comforting. You know, I mean, I always had problems when I first started, you know, reading about, you know, the Eastern philosophies, pretty much that you get absorbed into the, you know, the greater consciousness and not necessarily retain your own individuality. So I think the evidence, as you suggested, points to, I mean, otherwise, like, mediumship wouldn't be able to take place, you know? I mean, it's clear that memories and personalities survive. You know, how much and to what degree and for how long, who knows? But certainly for quite a long time, at least in our physical years, those can be communicated. You, I know we don't have much time, but I don't even know if you remember that you wrote it, but you made a statement in the same book: we don't go to another place, we simply have another dream. You remember what you meant by that?
Yes, I do. So
I didn't want to put you on the spot.
Yeah. It gets into physics a little bit, which I will spare you, but I make the case that life, reality, is like a shared dream where the things come into existence when we experience them. And then when we die, we continue to have experiences, and they may be back in another life here, or they may be a completely different kind of experience. But it's not like we hop on a train and go to another place. It's that we have this continuation of this dreamlike reality, which is what reality is, that it's growing out of mind, it's growing out of consciousness, and we just continue on with it.
Yeah. All right. So we have been talking with Dr. Jim Tucker. Jim's website is jimbtucker.com, but I encourage everybody not only to read Jim's books, because they're very compelling, but also find out more. I mean, just look up the University of Virginia Division of Perceptual Studies, and you will see everything that they're involved in. The scope is very broad, and really some top researchers in the world in that very division that Jim heads. So they're one of the beacons in this realm of discovery. So we appreciate them very much. Jim, thanks so much for being with us. It was my pleasure, as always. Hope to talk to you again soon.
Well, thanks. It was great talking to you, Bob.
Thanks. Have a good evening. Okay, that's a wrap for us. We will see you next week on The Gathering. You can email your questions in. Maybe some of them Jim already answered, so that'll make it easier for us next week. So everybody have a good evening, and we'll see you next week.